This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
So how should we tackle the subject of autism? As a health or medical issue, or as an education issue? You could make an argument for either. April is Autism Awareness Month, and we're going to look at it as something people live with. And there are stories about all of those lives.
It's a real variety of shared experiences.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the president and CEO of the Hospital for Special Care in Connecticut about their program called Spectrum of Kindness, which hopes to tell as many of those stories as possible. Then it's off to sea to talk to the chief scientist of the expedition that found the wreck of the Titanic. And we'll spend an academic minute with a word we're hearing a lot during this election season, gerrymandering. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. People have autism. Families live with autism, and every one of those families has at least one story to tell. Now those stories are being collected and shared through the Spectrum of Kindness campaign. The campaign started at the Autism Center at the Hospital for Special Care in New Britain, Connecticut. The hospital recently opened a special inpatient autism program, one of the few in the country. Lynn Rickey is the president and CEO of the Hospital for Special Care. I spoke to her about the hospital's Autism Center and the Spectrum of Kindness campaign.
So we actually started our autism services in 2012, really based on the significant need and the lack of resources, particularly in our state of Connecticut. And since that time, we've seen almost 1,000 kids on an outpatient basis. That then led us to developing the first and still the only what's called a patient-centered specialty practice. That's a mouthful, but essentially what that means, it's a national accreditation, and it looks at the way we deliver care, the coordination of care specifically around autism services. And it allows us to connect the services that we provide with other providers in the community and really help parents navigate through the very complex different systems that they have to work within in order to raise a child with autism. So as a part of that and an extension of our services, we looked at developing an inpatient program. And many people have said to me, you know, why would these kids need to be in an inpatient setting? And there is a segment of kids on the spectrum who have significant behavioral challenges, and that might include what's called self-injurious behavior, where they actually would hurt themselves, either hit themselves, bite themselves, something that would actually cause injury to themselves. And then, of course, there could be aggression and other, you know, mood-related disorders that would require them to come into an inpatient setting in order to have those managed. So we opened that in just December 28th of this past year, and that is actually the 10th in the country.
And I imagine you must have seen these kids first on an outpatient basis before admitting them?
We, in some cases, yes. We are actually, it's the only program in Connecticut that would serve kids who need an inpatient stay in a designated program. So, for example, many of these kids end up actually coming through the emergency rooms. So they would have a significant challenge at home that their parents would be unable to manage or unable to keep them safe. So they would end up going to an emergency room at one of the local community hospitals. And the challenge before that was they would get sort of stuck, if you will, in the emergency room while they were waiting one of the very few beds that would exist throughout the country. And the closest location prior to us opening our program is in Providence, Rhode Island. So they might stay in the emergency room for several days to, in some cases, several weeks, and then go home with sort of a, you know, Band-Aid on, if you will, of their behavioral issues, maybe referred to their outpatient psychiatrist. And then what we saw happening was really just a cycling back. So it never addressed the issue per se. It just put it at bay for a bit, and then they would recycle back. So most of our referrals come to us through the emergency rooms. They may or may not have been a patient in our outpatient program.
What type of age group are you serving with this?
We are actually, we have a pretty narrow scope there, and that's because we only have 8 beds designated. So we are serving kids from ages 10 to 21 in our program.
And are these children who are in school or some kind of educational program?
Yes, they are. All kids are required. The school systems are required to provide them with an educational component until age 21 in the state of Connecticut. So most of them are in programs that are specific to their needs. So although some of these children can be mainstreamed with support, many of them are in specialized programs because they have that underlying behavioral component.
And was it this specialization in autism services that brought you to the Spectrum of Kindness program?
Actually, it was, and it was a way that we reached out 3 years ago. We're very involved in the autism community as a whole. One of the things that we thought was really important, because there's just sort of a bottomless pit of need in terms of dealing with the many issues that families and kids with autism would face. So we were just a small part of that. And so what we did is looked at ways to connect with other providers and actually build what we've referred to as a neighborhood. We call it our autism universe, where we connect not only resources, we reach out to other resources, but we connect parents to resources. So we looked at how do we build this awareness, and really, as the numbers continue to increase, although the CDC did stay firm at the 1 in 68 as an incidence rate, but what we've done is tried to build awareness throughout the state of Connecticut initially, and now we, in our third year of the program, have brought this to a national forefront. And the goal is really connecting families, caregivers, and just really opening up the conversation, helping people feel comfortable talking about some of the challenges in raising a child with autism. I actually have my son Lincoln turned 20 yesterday. He is on the spectrum. And so obviously he's been a big motivation for me in trying to make sure that the world is more accepting of, you know, people, young adults like him, children like him, and also in making sure that we have the resources to help them have the best quality of life that they can have.
Well, let's talk about Spectrum of Kindness. What is the program? What does it do? And what are you inviting other people to do within the program?
Sure. So the Spectrum of Kindness is actually a microsite that exists. So it's a virtual community of folks who have any connection to autism. And so what we invite people to do is go to the spectrumofkindness.org website, and they can go online there and not only read stories and see videos that other people have shared regarding their experience with autism. And you know, I will tell you that there's just some incredibly moving stories. And one of the things, I happened to have shared one of the first stories because I figured if I'm going to ask others to do it, I needed to step up. And my story was really just about something that most people would take for granted, going to the grocery store. Well, going to the grocery store with a child with autism brings a whole new level of challenge. And so for me, what was really, my story was about knowing the cashiers and going in the right line that was going to be a good experience for Lincoln. And they actually, over time, just, I saw how kind they were. They recognized who he was and some of his special challenges, and were able to really make that experience not only comfortable for Lincoln and I, but also, you know, one that was, what, there was engagement, that they weren't looking away from him or just trying to hurry through the process. So there's all kinds of stories. There are stories of school bus drivers who've done something really remarkable, lots of stories of caregivers who have gone above and beyond, stories of people in have gone out to restaurants and how they've made that experience something that they don't have to dread, that they can participate in that part of, you know, the rest of, you know, sort of recreation that others would take for granted. So we have videos on there. We have just print stories with pictures. It's a real variety of shared experiences. And as I said, we actually have stories from across the country now, and that's our goal, is to really make this a national community and not just one that exists within Connecticut or New England.
It really is an amazing site with some fabulous stories. I'm sure you expect stories from parents and maybe even from some people who are on the spectrum. Have you gotten stories from people that you just didn't expect it to come from there?
You know, I think we didn't expect as many stories from what they call self-advocates or individuals who are on the spectrum. We expected more stories from their caregivers, but I think that is great because we're hearing from them and we're hearing, you know, through their voice and their word what it is they want to share about living with autism. And what I had somebody say to me is, I feel so much better equipped to be able to interact with somebody who's on the spectrum, so that when people look down or look away, they're not doing it, you know, in a malicious sense, but really because they don't know what to say or do. So what we feel like we've accomplished is we've equipped people to have a conversation and to engage, you know, an individual and their family so that they can make them part of the discussion.
Well, what's next? Where do you want to take this program?
Well, we, as I said, we'd love to, we have a campaign going on now, which is called the One Campaign, and that is actually helping us cover the state of Connecticut so that every individual in every city and town in Connecticut can be a part of our autism program. And it's actually, that's a fundraising campaign because, as you can imagine, this is a very resource-intense population, and many times the reimbursement doesn't cover the cost. So what we would like to do in a similar fashion is to, you know, cover the United States and have a story from every, you know, state across the country represented on the spectrum of kindness. I think that'd be a great goal to reach for.
And finally, let's look ahead for the hospital itself and that program. Where would you like to see that go in a few years?
Well, we really hope to be a national center of excellence, and we would love to be able to help others across the country replicate what we've done, because we know that this is not unique to Connecticut, and we have been very fortunate, I think, to grow that both the program and services and the number of individuals that we've been able to reach in a very short period of time, and for a long-term acute care hospital like ourselves, it's really a very unusual kind of niche market to be served. So we would love to help others do that as well across the country.
And I'm sure maybe you'd like to see in a few years those 8 beds turn into a few more.
Absolutely. We already have a plan for that.
See, I read your mind there.
You did.
Okay.
Good job.
What didn't I ask you that I really should have, that you want people to know?
I think, you know, the one thing is maybe just to give a little bit of background on who the Hospital for Special Care is, because I think that's why this program has been able to flourish. And we are, I mentioned a long-term acute care hospital, which is a lot of words. It doesn't really describe who we are. We're essentially a specialty hospital. So we're large. We're 228 beds serving the state of Connecticut and surrounding states, for really niche, complex, chronic populations. So we, everything from the core program at the hospital is actually respiratory care. So we have over 100 ventilators here at the hospital any day at various stages of recovery. We also serve patients with spinal cord injuries, brain injuries. We have a very large outpatient population that serves, or program that serves, patients who have muscular dystrophy. We do a lot of research and provide both care and research in the area of ALS, Parkinson's disease, really a variety of programs. And we also have an inpatient pediatric program, which is very unique. We're actually the only hospital with our licensure that sees both kids and adults.
Lynn Rickey is the president and CEO of the Hospital for Special Care in New Britain, Connecticut. You can learn more at spectrumofkindness.org. Still to come, we've talked to a lot of scientists on this program, but never one that found the Titanic. That changes next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Dr. Robert Ballard is a retired naval officer who has spent more than 5 decades working on underwater research and analyzing shipwrecks. Over the years, Ballard has discovered the German battleship the Bismarck and the USS Yorktown, both of which sank during World War II. In 2002, he discovered the shipwreck of the PT-109 that John F. Kennedy was aboard when it was rammed by a Japanese destroyer. But his most famous discovery came when he was the chief science officer on the expedition that discovered the wreck of the Titanic. Dr. Robert Ballard spoke to the best of our knowledge's Jim Lavoulis about his famous discovery and his life on the sea.
I go underwater to see what's there. And so shipwrecks are there, but everything else is there, too. So if you look at my background, I'm an oceanographer. My doctorate's in geology and geophysics. So I look at the Earth as a living creature. But it just turns out that most of it has water on it. And so I spend a tremendous, not 72% of my time underwater, but a tremendous amount of my time exploring. And I've been lucky to be at it now for 54 years. I'm turning 74 in June, and rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated. The public knows me for my adventures that reach the public domain with National Geographic, like finding the Titanic or finding the Bismarck or PT-109 shipwrecks. But that is really, I would say, a fraction of what I do. But certainly the Titanic was an amazing expedition. It was actually a cover for a series of Cold War military operations I was doing. I spent 30 years in naval intelligence, and during the Cold War, we were doing a lot of crazy things. But yes, the Titanic was quite an adventure, for sure.
When did you realize it was the Titanic?
Well, you know, when we went over the boiler. I mean, we were hunting. I mean, a lot of people had tried, and all had failed. And in fact, we were near the end of our expedition. We thought we were going to enter the almost ran group. And we were working, the Titanic, as you know, was in a transatlantic shipping lane. And it was a lane that was used a lot during World War II. There was lots of ships sunk by the German U-boats. So we expected to see stuff, you know, but stuff down there can be rusty stuff and you don't really know what it is. And so sure enough, we picked up some debris. We started crossing a line. We were running east-west. We knew the debris would be carried by the Labrador Current on a north-south direction, so we were trying to cut a perpendicular across it. And sure enough, on our ninth line, we came into what was, you could hear on the videotape, because we recorded everything, the word wreckage. But it was wreckage, you know, and it was just pipes and things that you couldn't tell what it was. I was chief scientist, so the chief scientist, our ship runs on a 24-7, 4-on-8-off watches. So every 4 hours, there's a watch change. So as chief scientist, your job is to be at the watch changes. So you sleep in two REM cycles, about 3 hours at a time. And your job is to make sure there's this seamless transition from one watch to the next watch so that they get their orders. And so I did that at midnight, and I went up to my cabin, and I couldn't sleep. There was something going on in my head. I don't know, some premonition or whatever. But I was reading Chuck Yeager's autobiography about 2 in the morning, and unbeknownst to me, below, they'd gone over this wreckage. No one wanted to leave the command center. And then the cook happened to be up. He gets up early to make bread and stuff like that. He was out on the aft deck, and he came into the command center, and they said, go get Ballard. And so he came up to my cabin and knocked on the door. And naturally, that was odd, to someone at 2 in the morning. I was way high up in the ship next to the captain's cabin. We sort of had identical cabins as a symbolic. I had my job, and he had his job. And he stuck his head in and said, the guys think you might want to come down. Well, bam, I probably ran over the poor guy. And as I came into the command center, we went over a boiler. And we had a picture of the boiler on the bulkhead of the command center, and there it was. So that was when we knew the wreckage was the wreckage of the Titanic.
And then what's running through your head after that realization?
There's two people inside of you. There's the professional, and there's the person. And the professional, you know, this was scoring the winning goal at the buzzer. So your natural instinct was to, everyone jumped up and down, and we yelled and screamed. But then someone in the command center made this innocent comment, she sinks in 20 minutes. Because it was 2 in the morning, she sank at 2:20. And that innocent comment was just, bam, it hit you that, wait a minute, this is where everyone died. You know, this is, you're at the spot where all these people died. And the mood just, boof, like a wall switch, shifted from celebration to, you know, deep reflection. And I said, let's stop the ship, and bring the vehicles up high enough off the bottom where we're going to hit anything. And let's go outside. And I'm going outside. And so we stopped the ship. The vehicles are now suspended beneath us at a couple hundred feet above 12,000 feet. And we had a memorial service, and the mood never went back. It just stayed somber as we went about this clinical documentation of the ship, and then made the promise to ourselves when we saw the pairs of shoes where all the humans had landed and they'd been eaten and their bones dissolved and their shoes were their tombstones. We all said, we're never going to touch anything. And we never did. We came back the next year, but we only filmed. We never touched anything. And that was just the mood that was set.
Dr. Robert Ballard is a retired Navy officer and a professor of oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. He spoke to the best of our knowledge's Jim Lavoulis.
As the son of a sailor, I went out on the sea for adventure.
Now that the election season is heating up, okay, it's been red hot for almost a year now, but there's a word we've been hearing a lot of, gerrymandering. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Gerrymandering is a big topic again this election season, but what about gendermandering? I am Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Barbara Palmer, professor in the Department of Political Science at Baldwin-Wallace University, details how a gerrymandered district might also decide which sex is elected as well as which party.
Gerrymandering, the manipulation of legislative district lines, is a powerful tool that can virtually assure that a particular political party can keep winning elections. But does the drawing of district lines also affect the success of female candidates? Is it possible to gendermander? Every 10 years, legislative district lines are redrawn. In most states, this process is controlled by state legislatures and is highly partisan and extremely contentious, especially now with the availability of detailed U.S. Census data. Ask any political consultant, and they will tell you that the demographic makeup of a district can predict whether a Democrat or a Republican will win. For example, Democratic districts tend to be urban, racially diverse, and have lower incomes, and Republican districts tend to be rural, southern, and have more traditional families. My co-author, Dennis Simon of Southern Methodist University, and I wanted to explore whether the demographics that do such a great job at predicting whether a district would elect a Democrat or Republican might also predict whether a district would elect a man or a woman. Turns out that they do, but in some surprising ways. In U.S. House districts, female candidates from both parties came from districts with the highest levels of education and income. For example, Representative Carolyn Maloney represents one of the richest districts in the nation, New York City's 12th district. Women also represent districts that are much more urban, and as a result, much smaller, averaging about 500 square miles, while men represent districts that average 2,500 square miles. Men tend to be elected in districts with higher proportions of people who are married, have school-age children, and have blue-collar jobs. There is a political geography to women's success. Consequently, whenever legislative district lines are redrawn, regardless of whether this is taken into consideration, the fate of female candidates is reshaped.
That was Barbara Palmer of Baldwin-Wallace University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.